and welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Sam is off on break this week, but with me in the studio are Josh and Autumn, and we're starting right away with some of our best words. Josh, Autumn, how are you guys?
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah, fabulous.
Yeah, so how was the eclipse?
Uneventful. It was just a little hazy.
Little hazy, little fun. I sat outside with the eclipse glasses, watched our partial eclipse.
I really enjoyed seeing everybody's pictures as they talked about how much they enjoyed it and what they were doing. It felt a little bit like everybody's doing a very similar thing right now.
Oh, yeah. Everybody's united for science, something that science informs us about.
The best part about it is it was like the only non-Trump story until it was a Trump story.
Well, here's the thing. What the heck does the solar eclipse have to do with best words, our political Trump segment? Any guesses? Any guesses? Huh?
Staring at the sun?
Trump doesn't know Alex? How eclipses work?
Don't look at it! Look away! Yeah, so besides the person who has been sworn in as our commander-in-chief being photographed looking directly at the thing you're not supposed to look at, which is a metaphor for basically the entire, you know, presidency. You also have reports of people having to see their ophthalmologists for putting sunscreen in their eyes, for applying sunscreen to their eyeballs.
Say what?
Yes, to protect from the damaging rays of the sun.
Oh, good grief.
So we've got some science education to do there. I think my favorite part of the Trump looking directly at the sun is that the announcement that the president has finally decided to set up a blind trust for all of his accounts.
Yes. I saw it definitely as an example of his internal mentality of, you can't tell me what to do.
You can't tell me what to do, but a staffer yelps out, you know, hey,
don't look.
Here, take the glasses. The one of the things that I saw also was this imagined comparison between how an Obama presidency would have addressed such a momentous and beautiful event. There would have been, educators on site. The whole lawn and rose garden would have been filled with children. There would have been telescopes to look at sunspots. Everyone would have had presidential tagged glasses, and it would be a collector's item. You would have the best science communicators on staff making announcements and making proclamations and explaining things, and it would be a huge news event. What does Trump do? Step out on the porch for a minute, give a thumbs up, look stupidly into the giant glowing ball, and have his wife look rather disgruntled and his kid kind of confused.
I love that part the best. Is like Melania had her glasses on and didn't bother telling Trump to put his glasses on. So I think there's something there.
Maybe a little bit of shrewdness on her part.
All the pictures I saw of Barron seemed to have him looking down, possibly at a cell phone. Not wanting to be anywhere else.
Uh-huh. So basically just like any other teenager that isn't inspired by things that, like, you maybe could bring science communicators on campus to inspire children. And it was a really fun and united thing. Like you said, Josh, it was the first thing in a long while that wasn't a Trump story until it became a Trump story. Why must you poison everything? Speaking of Trump poisoning and poisonous Trump, so you guys heard about his Phoenix speech, correct?
No, I don't know what you're referring to at all.
Oh, come on, Josh. So Trump had a big rally in Phoenix. Apparently, it had all the numerous thousands of attendees and no protesters outside.
Absolutely. 15,000 people in a 4,000-person venue.
So did you guys manage to look at the highlights of this particular speech?
The highlights where he lowlights his previous speech.
Yes.
Just like shove a little stuff under the rug that he said previously to whitewash what he was.
Yeah, what he was being criticized for, right? And we're talking about that Charlottesville comments where he says, "I said that racism is bad. I said that violence is bad." Conveniently neglecting to say that he had said on both sides. Exactly. Then he name drops, "Well, no, we don't want the KKK," as if you name drop KKK and says, "See, I've checked my boxes of naming all the despicable people and organizations." Well, in what looked to be slightly under an hour and a half, there were some little gems that I have selected for us to pick apart and analyze. You guys ready?
Let's go.
Have you steeled your stomachs? So, on the numbers of people there, Trump said, literally at the very beginning of his speech, just so you know from the Secret Service, there aren't too many people outside protesting, okay? That I can tell you. And then later, how about all week? They're talking about the massive crowds that are going to be outside. Well, where are they? Well, it's hot out. It's hot. I think it's too warm.
I think the Secret Service wasn't able to accurately report what's going on because they're a little under budget at this point.
Why would they be under budget, Josh?
They're kind of broke for some specific unknown reason.
Oh, you mean all of the vacationing and all of the traveling that Trump's been doing that has completely wiped out the yearly budgetary allotment?
And all the money that's been paid to Trump hotels and to Trump businesses?
Oh, man.
In order to house and feed the Secret Service that are protecting him?
Protecting him, protecting his family. And if you're in different locations, you have to have people on site in different locations. But this isn't just about the under budget, the over budgeted, overspent Secret Service. It's about denial of the fact that, well, okay, it's 105 degrees out at, you know, in Phoenix. That's not an unheard of thing in Phoenix. People still gather outside. I lived in Phoenix. It's about the underreporting of the thousands of people that were protesting.
And the tear gas that was slung and It was a protest, so it was not...
And tear gas that was not slung by the protesters.
No, not.
I have close friends that were activists. They were protesting there. They had tear gas exposure. Nobody, by all of their accounts, their personal accounts, who I trust, I know that, you know, it requires some verification, but this is me saying it. No one was acting violent. No one was acting aggressively towards anyone, and... Yeah.
If they were, we'd have video and pictures and nobody would stop talking about it. But since there's none.
Right. Well, the other thing that seemed really curious is that Trump proclaimed inside his poorly attended speech on a very warm evening, our movement is a movement built on love.
I don't think he knows what those words mean.
A movement?
Well,
I mean, unless it's preceded with bowel.
God is love. So, yes, it's a movement of love.
So I want to know what kind of movement he's talking about. I mean, is he talking about his own movement? Is he talking about Make America Great Again? Is he talking about all Americans? Is he talking about the protesters that are outside? Is he talking about the people that actually want to embrace LGBT folks? I mean, is he just picking words out of a hat, Mad Lib style? What is going on?
Well, it's just a specific type of love.
I think that Trump has very clearly figured out that if he states something with authority and sounds like he should not be questioned about it, it just passes and nobody questions him about it.
Well, by his movement.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, but even in the presidency, with him making the claims about how many people are at any given event, he knows that he can just make a statement and probably for a long time in his business life, nobody questioned it. Nobody fact checked. Nobody made a big deal about the lies that he spread. And now he has this response from people where they're calling him on every single one of them.
And his only recourse is to say, you know, insist that he's perfect and right.
And just crooked like, media.
Exactly. The crooked media. They won't tell you. He uses this amorphous they, which could at any time mean media outlets. It could mean protesters. It could mean people that don't support him. It could mean North Korea. But this use of they, man, for having kinship with a bunch of folks that are really averse to the pronoun they as saying that it's too confusing for non-gendered people. He really likes using they as this amorphous thing. So he's got a few other things. He says a wound inflicted upon one member of our community is a wound inflicted upon us all. That seems kind of nice. It seems like I am my brother's keeper. It seems like a very humanistic sentiment. I mean, we've heard that in a lot of different contexts, religious, non-religious, nationalistic, non-nationalistic. But I cannot help but interpreting this in not the nice, friendly, humanistic, all humans are brethren kind of thing. A wound inflicted upon one member of our community.
Yeah, I don't think any of us are in his community.
It's a pretty exclusive community, and gates and all. It's, you know, they have black servers as their waiting staff kind of community is what he's talking about.
Oh, well, in Phoenix or in his Mar-a-Lago or I'm not even sure. His New Jersey homes.
No, his largest, the largest winery in the United States in Charlottesville that he owns, supposedly.
Ah, okay, that one. So that's his community. So don't bother wounding them because it will wound everyone, right? So, you know, if someone maybe yells aggressively at a KKK member at a protest, then his entire community has been wounded. They've had wounds inflicted upon them. If of course, that warrants taking a vehicle and driving into those wounding people, right?
Right. Murdering people in response is absolutely the right thing.
But, you know, of course, it's the right thing for a movement built on love.
Remember, many sides.
Love of self, you know, right? So he also had more things to say about love. He says, I didn't say I love you because you're black, or I love you because you're white, or I love you because you're from Japan, or you're from China, or you're from Kenya, or you're from Scotland or Sweden. I love all people of our country. Which just was a baffling kind of thing for him to say.
And yeah, demonstrably wrong.
Really strange.
He didn't include Mexico. I did love his name checking of Kenya, right? So that's a funny one. We don't know anything about Trump's complaints about people from Kenya, right?
So he loves Obama then.
I guess. Well, here's the thing. He says, I didn't, it's this very tricky little language that says, I didn't say that I love you because of your nationality or your race. I love all the people of our country. Well, who does he count as people of our country?
Right.
Right.
So, a country of immigrants, but he doesn't include immigrants in the list of people.
Well, remember what he said about our community, right? It's
right.
The gold-leafed vacationing community, right? He also, here's the they, and the in this next quote, the best I can tell, he's referring to the media when he says they. He says, yes, by the way, they're trying to take away our history and heritage. You see that. And then later on in his speech, he said, they're trying to take away our culture. They're trying to take away our history.
Oh, I bet that's about the statues that are being taken down.
Most certainly.
Yeah.
And so is it they, the legislators, the media,
the protesters, the people,
you know,
who are demanding that these statues be pulled down.
And the rhetoric to say this is a wound inflicted upon us, upon our community. It's just atrocious. It's riling up these emotions and indulging these terrible, racist, vile emotions in people.
And they don't seem willing to respond to the calls for these statues to be moved to a museum or
private property
or a central space where people can see this and understand this is a part of our culture and our history, but not something to be lauded and to be celebrated.
I mean, right here in Tacoma, we have Chinese Reconciliation Park, which is a beautiful walking path with certain monuments and a big, a gazebo, what's it called?
Pagoda.
Yes, with history plaques all along the way about Tacoma's ugly history, a historical treatment of Chinese people about 100 years ago in our town. And it's called Chinese Reconciliation Park because it is a way to reconcile our atrocious behavior at the political level, at the governmental level, for a group of people, for a group of residents that were here trying to start their businesses, be immigrants. You know, they might have been children of immigrants that had had their parents and grandparents as slaves building railroads. That's the kind of park that can preserve that history and culture.
Absolutely. And none of us want to pretend that the Civil War didn't happen or that there weren't Confederate generals who led many people, that there weren't many soldiers who fought on that side. But the story is what needs to be told, not the celebration of the individual people who fought on either side.
So moving from one monument of hatred to another, he also, did his little wall drops, right? Believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall.
The wall that we're not supposed to pay for?
Yeah, was it not 6 months ago?
I mean, not even. But also, it was released recently, like, he was begging the Mexican president to, please, please, give us this wall. I need this political little, I'm paraphrasing badly, but it was pretty pathetic. It was not winning, Trump.
So you've got that kind of thing where, you know, he's threatening to shut down the government unless the government builds the wall, finances the wall. What finances the government? People.
Right. You'd think that all of the people who want to argue about what their taxpayer dollars are going to support would not be okay with their taxpayer dollars supporting
a monument of hatred?
Monument of hatred or Trump's businesses through the Secret Service or any of these things where all this money is being poured out of our government and yet they want to yell about education budgets and the NPR and things.
Yeah,
like that.
All kinds of things. Well, I gotta say though, Trump held this particular rally in Phoenix, in Arizona, Arizona, you know, I had lived there for 7 years, or 3 years, and Sam had lived there for 7 years, and we're well versed with the politics there, and we still have close relations and family and friends that live there. And I got to tell you, it's always been, you know, a conservative GOP stronghold. McCain is a well lauded senator who had a relatively successful presidential, you know, attempt, right? So runs, got a lot of support, and is now, of course, due to his illness, receiving a lot of, you know, laudits and things like that. And it's actually right there in Phoenix with Trump goading the GOP has actually produced very much the beginnings of rifts. So this is the thing. Trump was advised not to call out his GOP presumed allies. But in the middle of his speech, he actually references that he's not supposed to name anyone by saying, you know, they all said, Mr. President, your speech was so good last night. Please, please, Mr. President, don't mention any names. So I won't. I won't. No, I won't vote one vote away. I will not mention any names. Very presidential, isn't it? As if he's patting himself on the back. Very presidential. And that's clearly interpreted as a reference to McCain. He said, they told me not to say McCain, so I'm not going to say McCain.
Look what a good boy I am.
Right. Want a cookie? Want a bone? Want a treat? Right? And then he follows up with, nobody wants me to talk about your other senator who's weak on borders, weak on crime, so I won't talk about him. Nobody wants me to talk about him. Nobody knows who the hell he is. And that's a reference to Junior Senator Jeff Flake.
Who he insists on calling Flake, Jeff Flake, which yes. Is the opposite of clever.
So we've got all kinds of stuff, all kinds of baloney coming from Trump in his Phoenix address, not the least of which was a final little reference to one former lawman.
Oh, yes, our good friend, Mr.
Joe Arpaio, right?
So Sheriff Joe.
So, Autumn, you were telling me that at some point in the morning, there was a White House representative that had said nothing's going to happen with Joe Arpaio. Is that?
Yeah, they said it's not on the table. That's not an option. It's not going to happen.
So later on in the speech in Phoenix, just drops a little hint. Sheriff Joe, he's going to be just fine. And not 2 days later, what happens?
He pardoned him against all political or any kind of humanitarian
advice,
anything like.
So here we go. Donald Trump issued a pardon to former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio for the ex-lawman's illegal discrimination of Latinos on perceived immigration status. Trump's pardon comes after Attorney General Jeff Sessions rebuffed Trump's request to drop the federal case against Arpaio earlier this year. Senior Arizona Senator John McCain stated that Trump's actions undermine his claim for the respect of the rule of law, as Mr. Arpaio has shown no remorse for his actions. Trump's pardon of Arpaio occurred with no consultation of the Justice Department, which typically reviews all clemency pleas before giving a recommendation to the president. Now, I don't know how much folks in the Pacific Northwest are really sort of like dug into Arpaio, but having lived in Phoenix, having lived in Maricopa County, there were people there that were definitely all gung-ho about Arpaio, but there were people in the sheriff's office that for years would secretly campaign behind his back to try and get someone else elected to be sheriff because of how atrocious he was. Not only to his workers, it's really difficult conditions working in you know, correctional facilities and law enforcement and things like that, and there's lots of reports about folks that are, you know, sort of have their hands tied about what they want to do and feel immoral about it. But it's, you know, it's a paying job. But at the same time, you have people that are looking over the execution of the job of sheriff and the atrocities that Sheriff Joe was fomenting. So I don't know how much it came across up here in the Pacific Northwest.
And there was a claim that he has only been charged with a small fraction of the crimes that he's committed by another law enforcement member in Arizona.
Well, there's certain levels of crimes or doing things that are against the orders of federal judges. His crime that he was convicted of was actually being in contempt of court because a federal judge said, hey, stop your discriminatory profiling of Latinos based on their perceived immigration status. He refused to stop, so he was in contempt of court and was convicted of that and was due to be sentenced in October. But there's a whole bunch of things that, as a sheriff, might not fall under criminal purview, but he's had numerous lawsuits for awful things going on in the jail. I mean, Josh, you've heard just some of them, right?
It's such a long list. Speaking to the Pacific Northwest perspective of Joe Arpaio, basically, we would hear some things up here, what you'd hear pretty bad, but those list stats come from the site.
The Phoenix New Times?
Phoenix New Times.
So Phoenix New Times is sort of the alternative newspaper that's weekly, and it's akin to The Stranger in Seattle. It can be a little bit flippant here and there, definitely has a edgy and artsy vibe to it and things like that. But we were just reading a little bit of the things that the Phoenix New Times has then retweeted and saying, here are all the things that we've covered and investigated and reported on Sheriff Joe for over the years. And we're talking about 15 years of just horrible things. So you want me to read off a few of those?
Yeah, let's hear them.
So we got he ran a jail that he described as a concentration camp.
That's what I mean by himself. Like, he actually described it as a concentration camp. That's his own words.
Yes, that's his assessment of his prideful creation.
Loved it. This is full acknowledgement that he was behind everything.
He had prisoners die under his watch at a disproportionate rate to other correctional facilities.
A lot of hangings. A lot of suicides by hanging, supposedly.
So we had a jailer that nearly broke the neck of a paraplegic incarcerated individual who was in need of a catheter. So how's that? I mean, not only are you denying some basic hygiene dignity to an individual, but through the process of doing that, you have someone that ends up nearly breaking the neck of someone.
It's amazing. The physical force that it takes to break somebody's neck might not be a lot, but it's going to be intentional. And I mean, the guy needed the catheter. I mean,
that's for basic hygiene when you are paralyzed, and for comfort, for dignity, and even if you were an incarcerated individual, you have constitutionally protected rights to medical treatment and things like that are not going to leave you open to infection and things like that. But that's not even as far as he goes. We actually had a stillborn birth that I think it's a pending lawsuit where there is a alleged mistreatment of a woman who was in labor and who ended up losing her child because of being incarcerated under Sheriff Joe. And
there was more than one. There's just this specific case, but it comes on to the conditions was horrible, the high heat, but also the tainted water by a mouse feces.
So you got toxoplasmosis, which of course is dangerous to developing fetuses and pregnant women.
And a risk of hantavirus in Arizona.
Mm-hmm. So all sorts of things. We had some of the things that wasn't even across the Phoenix New Times, tweet storm was rotten ostrich meat being served to prisoners, cutting the caloric intake of individuals, pink underwear to make the prisoners feel humiliated because apparently he thinks that's humiliating for males to wear pink underwear, a return to the old-fashioned cartoon black and white striped uniforms.
Where do you get a surplus of ostrich meat? Where you just have it laying around and just went bad?
From an ostrich farm that just, has a surplus.
That's
on discount.
And yes, and so he lauded that as a shrewd use of county funds to make sure that all the county funds were being used appropriately. Sheriff Joe is an awful human being. He's a monster. He was convicted. He was tried and convicted on a very small infraction compared to his awfulness. And to have Trump pardon this individual who shows no remorse, who is proud of his past actions, just to me further enshrines Trump's fondness or nothing related to or approaching humanitarian, humanistic, values, or certainly not a movement built on love. Certainly not when a wound is inflicted upon a member of the community, a wound is inflicted upon everyone, unless he's a masochist and really likes being wounded. So, I'm just this week has been a lot. It's brought back memories of Arizona. I've had friends that were exposed to tear gas. I don't know exactly how we're going to get through it, but there's going to be something. There's going to be something on the other side. I don't know what's going to be happening exactly, but we'll get to it. This is Ask an Atheist, 844 Skeptic. We'll come back with maybe some less heated news or updates, things like that. Maybe a little thing to clear the palate.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Dorn. And we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month, we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is the United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio vs. the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
If you are a humanist, atheist, or freethinker from Everett, Washington to the Canadian border, Humanists of North Puget Sound welcomes you. Your freethought neighbors to the north have been promoting secular ideas for over 20 years. They're humanists with a rational worldview informed by science, inspired by art, and motivated by compassion. Join up for monthly conversation, camaraderie, and activism. Humanists of North Puget Sound. Visit humanistsnps.org.
Billy, I am a Nigerian prince, and I want to hide a bajillion dollars in your locker.
Wow, a bajillion dollars?
All I need is your lunch money.
What a great deal. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because you want to believe something doesn't mean you should. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled, week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
Back to Ask an Atheist, 844 Skeptic. That's our voicemail number. We'd love to get a voicemail every so often here and there. But for today, we've got Autumn in the studio. And Autumn, it's your first time here on Ask an Atheist in the studio.
It is. That's very exciting.
It's really nice to have you. Autumn O'Leary is an active volunteer with Camp Quest Northwest. She served as cabin counselor and program director for two different sessions this summer and a cabin counselor last year. This is her first time on Ask an Atheist. And we brought you in because, well, Josh, you also had your first time being a cabin counselor this year. And I've been involved in Camp Quest. But there was a really interesting new element to camp this year, and that was the introduction of gender neutral cabins. So we brought you in to talk about that as kind of our resident expert, as someone who's put a lot of thought into how to make that happen and then enacted it this summer. So Autumn, can you give us a little bit of background on what prior experience informed your work as a counselor for a non-gendered cabin?
Absolutely. I've been part of the queer community for a long time and have done a lot of listening to people who are non-binary or genderqueer or just exploring that concept of what gender means for them. And I also got to work at a camp called Camp 10 Trees that's also based out of Seattle. And it is an LGBT and children of LGBT camp. And working with them, I got to connect with a lot of people who had more personal experience in that realm, and really just being there and listening to their stories and hearing the experiences and the microaggressions that I don't think about on a daily basis because I don't ever experience them. But then being able to internalize a lot of that and then go forward into
Camp Quest and bring some of the best elements of that that I really appreciated about that camp and introducing it to Camp Quest. And luckily, Camp Quest was already on this track of gender-neutral cabins. There have been other Camp Quests across the country who have integrated gender-neutral cabins into their experiences. And so my co-counselor in June was a counselor from another Camp Quest session, and she had been in gender-neutral cabins before, and we got to have the one of the older cabins, the LT leadership track.
So what age were the kids in that cabin?
15 to 17. So 15, 16, 17, and they were a range of different people, different experiences, different identities.
So you said that you've been a part of the queer community for many years. How do you identify personally on the gender spectrum?
My response to that is, I think labels are useful when the people who are talking about them understand them. And I think gender is a dumb game. That's generally my response. I identify as genderqueer, and I generally present femme or female. I don't mind at all when people use female pronouns for me. I enjoy using gender-neutral pronouns, they, them, and really trying to integrate that into people's experience and into my experience. Because I think the more you use those things, the more you just make them a part of your daily experience or your common experience, the easier it becomes to have those changes in your language cortex.
So how do you think that your identification of that and your experience and you being upfront with that impacted the camp experience for the campers, for those teens you were working with?
I think just having it not feel foreign, not feel like it's something that they are coming to camp and they are the only ones, and now they have to explain to everybody at camp that they're genderqueer and what that means, or that they're trans and they want to use a different name than they were registered with, or any of those things. To be able to walk in and kind of hear and see and experience an adult who is going through that process, who has experienced a lot of those things.
So I'm a high school teacher, and one of the things that is kind of terrifying for a lot of high school teachers that maybe have certain programs or clubs or coaches is these overnight trips, right? And we always have traditionally had gender segregated hotel rooms or hostels and things like that, because the biggest thing besides someone sneaking on some, you know, little vodka bottles or, you know, some drugs or something like that is kids having sexual contact with each other. And so traditionally, the way to avoid that is to enforce gender segregation. And so for some folks that may be coming from that perspective of youth development, it would seem anathema to have a mixed gender cabin or a gender neutral cabin. How did you address issues of privacy and sort of boundaries of sexual contact? Because these are 15 through 17 year olds. And I don't know about you, but I had my first kiss at summer camp, sleepaway camp, and I'd be all over that gender neutral cabin. How do you then enforce those boundaries?
We integrated that into the very first day, the very first conversation that we had with the campers when they came in, and made them a part of the process of setting those boundaries and expectations. We all sat down and decided, what do we want this cabin experience to look like? We all get to create this. And I brought up questions like, well, how do you guys feel about the idea of nudity around each other? And they all decided and agreed, oh, let's keep it underwear and underwear on. But if you're changing, you know, clothes, that your outerwear, that's just fine. Other than that, you sneak off to the bathroom or to one of the side rooms so that you can have that privacy.
So, Josh, you were a cabin counselor for an all-boys cabin. Were those the kinds of conversations that happened there, too, in terms of, you know, if you got to change from your night clothes, your jams into your day clothes, or change into warm clothes before a campfire? How did you guys address that?
Generally, I mean, it's not an issue because it was underwear. You're not going to nobody's going to get out of their skivvies in any of the gendered or non-gendered cabins. So, it's really a non-issue. Basically, people change in the showers or they'll change their clothes depending on what time of day it is. We would actually segregate off in a part of our cabin that they can go to if they didn't even feel comfortable at that point.
So there's that little side room that you can sort of have a curtain and a little bit of privacy, even for someone who was in a cabin with a bunch of folks of the same gender.
I know in our August camp, one of the gender neutral cabins hung a sheet between two of the beds, and they kind of created a little changing room for themselves. And anybody who wanted to duck back into there and use that space, they had that privacy.
I will say that was my pink and white polka dot sheet that I offered to that cabin.
Yeah, I think next year I'm going to donate a couple of my ponchos for that kind of usage, because it actually works out pretty well.
Nice.
And it's an easy way to integrate the ideas of both fighting body shame and letting people know that it's okay to see our bodies and to, you know, do what we need to do to take care of our bodies, and that you have full autonomy. You get to decide how naked you want to be in front of people. You get to decide what you are okay with seeing, and discuss that with your cabin mates. And
so if there's someone who feels perfectly comfortable with being naked from the waist up in a cabin, but it makes other members of their cabin uncomfortable, how do you then approach that?
I think that that's something where you have to have that conversation with the campers, and talking to the camper who wants to be able to become as nude as they want to become, they have to understand that our society has boundaries, and getting the consent of everybody involved is still a really important part of that.
And then in terms of, you know, avoiding that sexual contact, because you have, you know, kids in that environment that it's highly charged. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of hormones and emotions, and camp has so many bonding experiences that are actually, you know, targeted for. How then do you monitor that? Because as a parent, you know, as a hypothetical parent, I don't know that I would feel comfortable sending my kiddo to that kind of camp.
Oh, so for this, you wear them out. Like, they have no energy at the end of the day. They are ready to go to sleep.
That's a great idea for all ages and all genders, is to just get them they already are. They're just so tired by the end of the day that they collapse into their beds, still in most of their clothing, and fall asleep. And
I had the nightmare numbers. So my cabin was 8 to 10 year olds. That should be a nightmare scenario, but at the end of the day, they were ready. They were great kids.
Face planting onto the pillow and out.
And with the 15 to 17 year olds, we had we actually had two in our cabin, a male identified and a female identified person who were dating over the course of the week. They started dating on day two and they broke up on day five, because that's how summer camp works. But we were able to have those conversations with them about what's appropriate. If you guys want to sit on one of the bunks and have some cuddly time while everybody is awake and the lights are on and everybody's interacting, we're going to allow a little bit of that, because we want you to learn when it's appropriate to share kind of PDA and when it's not, and what those boundaries are. And so we can have those conversations out loud rather than them sneaking off into the woods.
I think it's really important to acknowledge and understand that teens are experimenting with physicality, with saying, you know, can I braid your hair? Can I give you back rub? Can we hold hands? And sometimes that doesn't have to be about sexual contact, but just exploring those kinds of things in a different way from how you interact physically with, you know, when you're 8 to 10, when you're rough and tumble, when you're, you know, doing piggybacks in the water for chicken fights and things like that. Different kind of physicality. I think it's really important to acknowledge that with teens and then help them through that.
And I think when adults have a fear response to any sort of physical intimacy between any two campers, it pushes that and it makes them think, oh, well, now I really want to explore this.
So you had mentioned that you enjoy using gender-neutral pronouns in different circumstances and contexts to kind of normalize that and get it into our language cortex. And pronouns are a huge aspect of sort of social existence for trans and non-binary and gender non-conforming people, and especially teens. So how did you address that with your cabin and then with the greater camp at large?
That was definitely something that was new to camp. The idea that when introducing ourselves, that we would introduce ourselves by our names and then also by our pronouns. And so we found times to integrate that into programming. Like you said, in our cabin, when we did our introductions initially, we asked for name, we asked for pronoun, we asked for grade, and something interesting about them. And so it was just part of the introduction. There was nothing special about it. I asked them if they knew what it meant when I said, "What is your pronoun?" one of the campers lit up. They were so excited because they use they, them pronouns and they identify as genderqueer. And they thought that camp was going to be this whole constant experience of them educating other people. And they walked in and there was just a place for them.
It's pretty excellent, as you know, if I can think of any awkward time that I felt as a teen, and I did not and do not identify as genderqueer, and just to have anything that relieves you of a little bit of that burden of trying to define or explain who you are, and just having that freedom to exist without having to do that.
Yeah, and then we also integrated it into programming for all ages. We have something called Socrates Cafe, where the campers are getting to interact about a topic. And so in our introduction of that, I explained to everybody from 8 to 17 what pronouns are and got them to talk about that and what their choices were for that.
It's pretty neat. I was wondering if all the campers in this gender-neutral cabin were genderqueer or non-binary, or if there were some girls that identified as girls, or some campers that were, you know, identified with their assigned gender.
Yeah, cisgendered campers. Yeah, we had a range. And part of it was that the parents, when they were signing their campers up, they got to select that they either their camper preferred to be in gender-neutral cabins, was willing to be in a gender-neutral cabin, or would prefer not to be in a gender-neutral cabin. And the majority of our campers were marked as that they were willing to be in a gender-neutral cabin, with a few who requested it. So we had everyone who requested gender-neutral cabins in one, and then we had a number of people who said they were willing. So we had cisgendered male campers, we had cisgendered female campers, we had one genderqueer camper, and then in August, there were a whole nother slew of those same.
And in August, we ended up with two cabins, an older age group and a younger age group. So it's kind of interesting to see that this isn't just an issue that faces teens, but really all youth and all humans, right? It's not just a gender experimentation phase for high schoolers or for middle schoolers, right?
And we got to have those conversations with them when a group of campers was going into the girls' bathroom, and two of them turned to one of the others and said, "You can't come in here, you're not a girl." And there was a counselor standing there, and they had a conversation about it and what it, you know, why bathrooms are gendered and whether or not that's something that we're going to use at camp, and how camp is a place where we get to be who we are. And it doesn't matter what bathroom you walk into. You walk into the bathroom that you feel most comfortable with.
Because when you're in a bathroom using a toilet, the door's closed, you're the only one in there. You know, nobody's seeing your genitals. There's right. No exchange of visuals for anyone, counselors, campers, any ages, right?
Exactly. That's a time for us to have personal, private time to take care of ourselves and our needs. And it does not matter what's going on, whether or not you're showering or you're going to the bathroom. That should be your private time.
So basically, anything below the belt is not relevant to who you are as a person.
Absolutely.
Unless it is relevant to you personally. It's kind of an interesting thing. I wanted to know, you know, Camp Quest, we've been going as a whole organization for about 25 years, as a Northwest affiliate for 6 or 7 years now. And I wanted to know how, Josh, Autumn, how you guys see gender neutrality and acceptance of trans and non-binary individuals intersecting with humanistic values.
There's nothing I value more than personal identification. I mean, that when people talk about freedom, that's got to be up there very high on the list, is your own personal identification, how you see yourself. And society shouldn't shame you for seeing yourself or something that's a little bit, that's counter to a norm.
And I think that if we're going for lack of individual harm as an important aspect of humanism, that there is so much harm that is done to trans or non-binary people on a daily basis that people may not be aware of, that it's not just the blatant anti-trans and transphobic actions that are a problem. There are all sorts of little things that happen that just make it really difficult to be trans. And so trying to, again, make camp a safe place and make camp a place where you get to experience yourself and explore your own identity in a safe way.
So I want to push a little bit on this aspect of safe space, because sometimes when people hear this should be a safe space, or I deserve a safe space,
they get
or
triggered.
This must be a safe space, right? We have these words that are hot button words. What kind of things does safe space mean that a camper isn't pushed or challenged in any way?
Well, absolutely not. I think that pushing that growing edge is a huge part of camp. You're experiencing things you've never experienced before and coming into contact with people who you may not have interacted with before. And I think that this is just another aspect of how they are facing that growing edge of their own identities and their own understanding of other people's identities.
Well, Josh, Autumn, I'm really excited to be able to have this conversation. If there's folks that maybe are interested in Camp Quest, but maybe not so comfortable with their child or with themselves being in a gender neutral cabin or a cabin or a camp that has people that maybe present as female but prefer male pronouns, what advice would you have for them?
Just be accepting of other people. I mean...
Yeah, I think that it's important. I think that the main thing is that it's a shift in perspective, and it's acknowledging that everybody is deserving of respect. And that includes respect when somebody says, this is how I'd like you to address me. This is the name I'd like you to call me. And respecting that everybody gets to choose what clothing they wear, whether or not they wear makeup or nail polish or
jeans
or
a pantsuit.
Absolutely.
So all of those things that may be, perpetuated by society, maybe entrenched by religion about gender segregation, about gender roles and gender norms can kind of, someone who might be attracted to a camp built on secular humanism for kids and for volunteers who are not affiliated with religion, kind of keep that in mind and saying, hey, this is a way to push back and against some of those norms that are entrenched with religion and explore sort of a wider aspect of humanity.
And it's also a place where it's safe for those who haven't experienced it and may be uncomfortable with it to ask questions and to have people around, especially counselors around, who can have those conversations with them and answer their questions. I think that's really important.
Well, I'm really happy to have this conversation. I think that it's only going to unfold more as more spaces, more youth-serving organizations acknowledge these kinds of things. This is Ask an Atheist, 844 Skeptic. We'll be back after the break.
Has In God We Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster In God We Trust on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an In God We Trust decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists, non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at originalmotto.us.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
My name is Jonathan Ariola of TDTFPod. The more voices you hear, the more we observe and feel, the more we learn about the other facets of this complex and wondrous beast that is humanism and free thought. Join me on the science-loving journey through topics like justice, murder, family, diligence, taste, history, society, race, boob jobs, law, addiction, video games, fear, sacrifice, children. Wait a minute, not sacrificing children, that's not what I meant. Bring the popcorn and watch me break down the issues too deep, too fast. Join me at TDTFPod. I'm Jonathan Ariola. Talk to you soon.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American Soccer League.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-free football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com.
I want to bring it back, but it's more than basic.
Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. We've had quite the summer, but not quite as destructive as some people's summer. We've had a wonderful rain-free summer, which is a little bit worrying for us here in the Pacific Northwest. But elsewhere in the United States, unfortunately, we've had in Texas one of the wettest months of August on record. And right now, we have our friends in the Houston area and the Galveston area experiencing Hurricane Harvey. So we want to make a very important call to action. Foundation Beyond Belief's Humanist Disaster Recovery is now raising funds to assist those most in need in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. It's ongoing right now. As of Sunday, today, we've had the whole weekend with intermittent tornado warnings. People are being forced to look at going into their basement and lowest interior spaces to protect themselves from tornadoes, yet at the same time reach high grounds and attics and second floors in the threat of flash flooding. The ground in the region's already super saturated. Some areas are expected to receive more than 30 inches of rain. There's no place for that water to go. Bayous are already overflowing. Creeks are overflowing. Meteorologists and experts in disasters have forecasted that the effects of Harvey will be unprecedented in many areas, and recovery organizations are already mobilizing. So Foundation Beyond Belief, a great partner organization for any humanists and friend of the show, has two staff members actually right now, including Executive Director Noelle George. She's been on our podcast in the past. Their homes directly are threatened at this time right now. There's people all over the area that have had to choose between evacuating, leaving their homes, open to both the possibility of unauthorized entry from individuals, disaster, being flooded. So we really want to encourage you to go to foundationbeyondbelief.org. There are links there for donating to Humanist Disaster Recovery. Another announcement that I want to alert us all to do is tonight, podcaster Callie Wright of the Gaytheist Manifesto, love their title, they're hosting a live broadcast this evening. This is Sunday, the 27th, 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern time, and it's to benefit FBB Humanist Disaster Recovery efforts. So fellow Freethought podcasters will be appearing, including Marissa Alexa McCool, Steve Shives, Danielle Moscato, Matt Dillahunty, Aaron Raw, Seth Andrews, Thomas Smith, Andrew Torres, and Eli Bosnick. So we really want to encourage you to be motivated to help our fellow humans, to help people that are working really hard for better societies, because this is an unprecedented disaster. And when you have squabbling between political heads, between the governor of Texas, Governor Abbott, and the mayors of the individual towns, where you're having unclear instructions about whether to evacuate or whether not to evacuate, when you're having a commander in chief who finds it to be more appropriate to ban trans people from the military when the National Guard is being activated in Texas, because, as if a trans person can't hand out water and emergency blankets at a shelter to, hurricane victims, it's really important to stand with people and help in a way that you can. And everything that goes through FBB, everything that goes through Foundation Beyond Belief is vetted to be non-proselytizing, to be secular in practice. And FBB will occasionally partner with religious organizations, but all of the activities, all of the recovery efforts, all of the donations are distributed and executed in a secular way. So you don't have to worry about people coming into a hurricane-ravaged area and saying, before we eat and partake in this emergency ration, let's bow our heads and pray. You don't have to worry about saying, I'm sorry that we can't evacuate you right now because we don't have a shelter that will accommodate your companion animals.
But here's a Bible.
But here's a Bible, and pray to God for strength as your home is flooded. You don't have to worry about that. And it's a really concrete, tangible way to help at this time. So I just had a little shiver when I remembered that the trans military ban actually happened.
I know, that one really, really bothers me.
So we had a few weeks ago, actually, a little behind the scenes production info. We were going to talk about the big trans ban tweet, but we figured after a minute, Mattis had said nothing different is going to happen. This wasn't an executive order. This wasn't a memorandum. This was just a tweet from a twit. And, you could count it among the other 3 a.m. things that
exactly.
He's screaming
he's
about.
He's tweeted so many things that have had so little bearing on reality.
But unfortunately, this has become reality with Trump signing
ugly head.
Right. Signing a memo saying there shall be no recruitment of trans people into the military, no new people coming in, no VA benefits for people requiring anything associated with their medical transitions. That one scares me tremendously because we know that, you know, that you can have maybe things like hormone replacements or surgical alterations to help with a medical transition of a trans individual. But there's so many other kinds of things medically that affect trans people that aren't associated with them being transgender or gender nonconforming or non-binary. And we don't know whether this directive will embolden certain providers or VA heads to say, you know what, your gallbladder surgery is not necessary. And if only you weren't taking your hormones, you wouldn't have had gallbladder problems.
Right. It's an arbitrary line for people to make decisions about other people's health and well-being.
Maybe if you hadn't been wearing high heel shoes as the man that you are, you wouldn't have had bone spurs. So we're not going to operate on your bone spurs. I mean, this is the kind of thing that these directives can lead to. And it's terrifying for me to say that people who are dedicated to ostensibly serving our country are being cast aside and at risk of medical neglect.
So I'm going to be a little silver lining on this. Just because there's a memo coming out of the White House doesn't mean that this is legally valid. So perspective-wise, this is terrible, awful in every perceivable manner. But the thing is, it's going to be tested legally. And ironically, it's going to cost more than any of these supposed expensive operations.
Covering the medical costs?
The medical costs are going to be swamped by legal costs now.
The thing that scares me is the part that includes that the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security get to determine how to address transgender individuals currently serving based on military effectiveness and lethality, unitary cohesion, budgetary restraints, applicable law, and all factors that may be relevant. And that's going to affect so many out trans people who come against any sort of issue or butting heads in their ranks and just puts all of them at risk. Whether or not anything comes to pass, it gives carte blanche to those officials to make some really serious problems without any oversight or control.
Well, this brings me to an email, and this is actually Todd from Facebook. So not technically an email, but some feedback. And Todd says, "Hey, I usually love your shows, but I'm hearing way too much Trump talk. I do enjoy world news and such, but maybe put one political glove back on." And this is, I think, reference to Sam saying we've taken the political gloves off on the show. And I know that Sam's addressed it before, but when you have these egregious things going on from a governmental standpoint that are at odds with the rights of atheists, that are at odds with humanistic values, it seems like a perfect place to be able to talk about it. And when there's so much stuff going on, sometimes, you know, things fall through the cracks and you miss these. You miss these little incidences, or maybe you weren't fully informed about them. So I'm not giving up now on the Trump talk. We'll try and intersperse it with some of the other stuff. But I think a little bit of political barehandedness is what you're in for, Todd. So we do appreciate your listenership and hopefully you can get through it.
And unfortunately, it's easy to say, let's not talk about this anymore when it's not affecting you directly. But there are so many levels of this that you may not be aware of how this is going to affect you.
Exactly. So let's get off the topic of Trump for one little thing, and still sticking along medicine, and let's go all the way across the pond to Scotland. The Humanist Society of Scotland has called on the Scottish government to end the funding of homeopathic treatments. Homeopathy has continually been shown time after time to be no more effective than a simple placebo, as has stated HSS Chief Executive Gordon McRae in a letter to Scottish Secretary for Health Shona Robson. This comes shortly after NHS England announced that homeopathic prescriptions or referrals would no longer be available at the NHS, making Scotland the only part of the UK where it is still funded. The Scottish government has said that it recognizes that some complementary and alternative medicines, including homeopathy, may offer relief to some people suffering, and that it will continue to offer it as a choice for individual health boards. I'll add... for now. as atheists and as humanists, we also get a skeptical bent to us. And that homeopathic thing, right? I can see when you say complementary and alternative medicines offer some relief to people suffering. You know what we call that relief?
Placebo effect.
Sure, people talk about how like they feel relieved after they take a medicine that doesn't do anything, but they think that as long as they believe that it does a thing, it's a placebo. It doesn't have to be homeopathy. The reason why homeopathy is such a terrible thing is because it's literally somebody selling you water and saying it does a thing when it does not do a thing.
That hypothesis has been absolutely falsified. And, you know, I mean, one part of me says if it helps you feel better, that's the bottom line. That's a good thing. But when we're spending governmental money on something that is absolutely proven not to do the thing that it claims, that's a problem.
Yeah, it's called fraud.
And when people are faced with the idea of what are they going to spend money on for their health care, they should be, the government and health agencies should be encouraging them to choose the things that are going to have the greatest effect on their physical health. And many people have no idea what things are homeopathic, things like rescue remedy and those kind of treatments that people have to take and feel relief from. Placebo effect only goes so far.
And when you have a government saying, yes, we'll reimburse, then it gives an air of authority of says, you know, if it's on the NHS schedule, then it must be something that's effective. So we still got a lot of work to do in terms of educating and understanding those things in terms of what's effective.
Right. And also, so if you take in a placebo effect, something for the placebo effect, you're ignoring the underlying cause of what's actually causing the illness. So you're not actually being better. You feel better. You're going for the psychosomatic effect. So that is a direct harm.
It could be a real danger.
Right. Illness could be ravaging that body.
Well, that's what we got in terms of time today. This has been Ask an Atheist. I am the producer of this episode, Becky Friedman. Josh, thank you for co-hosting with me. And Autumn, thank you for being our guest host today.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Becky.
Our music is by Chris Coleman and Phil Whitfield. Donate to FBB's Harvey relief efforts. Listen to the Gaytheist Manifesto tonight. And until next week, resist and persist.